The purpose behind this series in the Psalms is much more than just to go back to the Old Testament and see our theology from a different angle. It's more than just to do verse-by-verse explanations or exegesis from inspired scriptures that we normally don't pay attention to. The ultimate long-term purpose of this series in the Psalms is that we would be more equipped for battle. And in particular, I think even that the next generation would see how they are to approach their lives, and specifically they're to approach their lives and the circumstances that they encounter, they're to do it in worship. And of course, the Psalms are songs to be sung, many of them in corporate worship. And part of the reason why that's beneficial is because then in our singing and in our worship, we are learning how to handle our different griefs and groanings. There are a lot of psalms that are written in the midst of trouble. Some that get higher in encouragement by the end. Some psalms that actually don't really even make it out of the discouragement at all. A lot of songs that remind us of the nature and character of God, like these do. A lot of psalms that teach us what we're supposed to do when we hit various circumstances. And so, more than just going verse by verse through an Old Testament book, it's intended to bring to our mind, to get into our collective thinking, that we need worship, we need songs, in particular the inspired songs in the book of Psalms. We need these in order to know how to handle the things in our lives. And it has already, to some extent, started to show little teeny bits of fruit. It was a month or more ago, maybe I mentioned this last time, but a month or more ago, I was working on a Saturday back in my little closet area and trying to work on some stuff for the Sunday morning liturgy, and I heard Calvin over in his room singing, "And like olive plants, thy children compassing thy table round." And you know what? He really has no idea the significance of that at this point. But to get those kinds of lyrics in to talk about how we look for God's blessing, and again, especially how we deal with our afflictions and our sufferings, we want for ourselves and for the following generations to be equipped with this kind of lyrical weaponry. And that's what these psalms are providing with us. Tonight, we're getting ready to sing it. I leaned over to offer to share the lyrics with him, and he said to me, "I don't need it, I know it." Well, that's what we want for all of us. Not that we memorize every psalm, but that those be the kinds of things that we're ready to go, ready to sing, ready to share when we see others in discouragement as well. So that when we speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, we have the kind of content that they might be encouraged with. Psalm 5 is no exception and has a significant amount of lyrical theology, poetic theology, and even singing help for us tonight. When we talk about God who authors the great story of history, and not only the great story, but every sentence on every page in the story, so every little subplot, every little thing that you encounter, be it a cold or interpersonal conflict or major decisions as you look ahead at your week or at your life and you're not sure what to do, or bills that are due, attacks from other people, whatever situation you might find, God is the author of those individual subplots in the greater story. And we do well to remember that as the author, he is writing as the omniscient three persons. Maybe you've heard the omniscient third person voice that's sometimes said in different novels or books. In this case, God is the omniscient three persons. He knows all of the details, and he puts the characters in place on purpose. When we see trouble, we ought to be able to immediately know that it isn't accidental. It certainly is no surprise to God. And Kuyperian Calvinistic type people, at least on paper, believe that the Lord writes as the Lord. That Lord is not just a title that we call him by. Lord is actually an office that he holds and rule that he puts into practice, even in every part of his story. And because we are learning to read his story and see how he develops characters and plots, at the beginning of that process, I don't think we're always ready to see tension or nuance. We like our stories more simplistic. As we mature, we see more. And this is why we're benefited by his grace, so that we can grow. But I say that to get to this point, because once we have come to know God as God, which we need to get to that point, once we have come to really grasp that he is Lord and we need to surrender to him, that he's in control of it all, and that's good, once we have been humbled by his sovereignty, once we've been humbled by his sovereignty, at times all we can see is his sovereignty. At times all we can see is his initiative and his power. That's all that's visible to us. And while that's better than thinking of him as docile or as impotent, it doesn't necessarily keep us out of the ditch on the other side if all we can think about is God as sovereign. Men have imagined many powerful gods. They have fictionalized false idols with galactic might and power. Men have not conceived of a God of power and holiness who hates sin. Men don't make up those kinds of gods. That's where we get into trouble, is when we can only see the one side, he is sovereign, and then we look around and we see a lot of sin and depravity, and we put that back into our newly learned understanding of God. God is sovereign. Oh, God is sovereign over the evil and the wickedness. Oh, God must not mind it. And like I say, men have created a lot of powerful, if not omnipotent, false gods in their imagination, but no man has conceived God as we find him revealed in Scripture. That he is omnipotent, and that he absolutely hates evil. Even we struggle to remember and hold together in our thinking that God is in heaven and he does whatever he pleases, and that he abhors the sinful, and that those two things come together when he writes evil into the story for sake of his glory and for the gracious good of his people. That requires a more careful reading. It would be easy to put him on one side or the other. God is absolutely holy. He hates sinners. Therefore, he can have no control over it because look at how much of it is happening. Or God is absolutely in control and there's a lot of evil around, so he must actually be the one making it all take place. And that's why we need Psalm 5, and we need David's help, who is writing another song in more trouble, not only to tell us who is in control, but to also tell us what the character is like, what God's character who is in control, what his nature is like. For a man after God's own heart, For the man called the sweet psalmist of Israel, David sure suffered a lot of anguish. And this is another lyrical poem intended for corporate worship that reminds us of God's sovereignty, why we can trust Him, and that reminds us of His holiness, that He detests wickedness and evil. When we find ourselves then in a position to groan, this is where we go with our groaning. We go to song. We go to song to God in particular. Let's read Psalm 5. If I knew a tune to it, that'd be better. We'd sing it. But I don't, so I won't. So we're going to read it. Starting with the heading, "To the choir master for the flutes, a psalm of David. Give ear to my words, O Lord, consider my groaning. Give attention to the sound of my cry, my King and my God, for to you do I pray. O Lord, in the morning you hear my voice, in the morning I prepare a sacrifice for you and watch. For you are not a God who delights in wickedness, evil may not dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all evildoers. You destroy those who speak lies. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. I will bow down toward your holy temple in the fear of you. Lead me, O Lord, in your righteousness because of my enemies. Make your way straight before me. For there is no truth in their mouth. Their inmost self is destruction. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Make them bear their guilt, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Because of the abundance of their transgressions, cast them out, for they have rebelled against you. But let all who take refuge in you rejoice. Let them ever sing for joy. And spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may exult in you. For you bless the righteous, O Lord. You cover him with favor as with a shield." The heading, as I've already mentioned, indicates that this is another song of David and another psalm delivered to the choir master to be used in Israel's corporate worship. That is part of the point, is not only that this is a private meditation and prayer and song of David, but that it's intended for the multitude, for the congregation, because this is something that will help them learn how to deal with their groaning. This intends to remind them of who their God is and where joy comes from. This particular number was for the flutes, that is, to be sung with flute accompaniment. Maybe the strings were soothing in the evening. We saw that in verse 4, with stringed instruments seemed to be, according to verse 8, lie down and sleep. So the strings maybe were more soothing for the nighttime. Maybe flutes in the morning were more like bird sounds, birds chirping, reminding one of the new day that is waking, and therefore a waking of hope and singing to God. Maybe these wind instruments would be a pleasant start. Unlike Psalm 3, there's no historical context provided for the particular trouble, so it goes unnamed. And it bears repeating from previous psalms where there have not been historical context given, that generalized lyrics allow for generalized applications. Which means that if you find encouragement in the setting that is not particularly named, then that's part of the purpose. Learning to sing this song helps to deal with a variety of difficulties. And the song itself has 5 stanzas. And if you're reading an ESV, you can actually see the break in between these 5 stanzas, alternating between the righteous and the unrighteous. So the first, third, and fifth stanzas have to do with the righteous and calling to God and worshiping Him and rejoicing in Him. The second and fourth stanzas have to do with the unrighteous and what their character is like even before God, how He responds to them, and the judgment that they deserve in the fourth stanza. So five stanzas, and I'm going to try to give a summary phrase for each one as we go through. I'd say stanza one, so verses 1 to 3, refers to watchful prayer. Watchful prayer is a way to summarize this first stanza. Not that there was much of a mystery, but if you saw the subtitle for the message on Twitter or Facebook, where to go with your groaning, if you saw that, not that there's much mystery, we ought to take our groaning to God. Let's go back to verse 1. Give ear to my words, O Lord, consider my groaning. Give attention to the sound of my cry, my King and my God, for to you do I pray. O Lord, in the morning you hear my voice. In the morning I prepare a sacrifice for you and watch. There's three imperatives that call God to attention. Three commands: give ear, consider, give attention. And the trouble is so bad, however, that only one of the things that David asks God to listen to is articulate. Meaning, out of the three times that David calls God to give attention and to hear and listen, one of them for certain is not verbalized, that is, it's not with words, groaning, and maybe the last one isn't either. So the call is for God to listen to my words, then my groaning and the sound of my cry. The last two are audible, but probably not verbal. There was some kind of sound being made, but it was an indistinct sound. The grief weighs so heavily that his words failed. There was groaning and anxiousness and pressure and weight and no words. But he brings this grief, this groaning to God. In fact, he calls him my King and my God. Where do you go with your groanings? You take them to the throne. You take your groanings to God's throne, who is King, who reigns over all. And there's reason for us to have hope when we know that we get to go to the King. We're not going to the impotent one, we're going to the omnipotent one. And we bring our concerns to Him. In this case, the call comes early in the day. In the morning, you hear my voice. In the morning, I prepare a sacrifice for you and watch. David uses the word prepares or prepare. It is a word that's sometimes used to talk specifically of actual sacrifices, and the ESV adds sacrifices in here. That's fine. The phrase in Hebrew is just, O Lord, in the morning, you hear my voice. In the morning, I prepare for you and watch. So prepare what? Well, the ESV adds in sacrifices. That's okay. The word prepares is sometimes used to talk about arranging the wood. Leviticus chapter 1 talks about preparing or arranging or ordering the wood for the altar, or even arranging or ordering the animal as the sacrifice. So yes, that's true. But here in this case, the sacrifice that David is arranging and ordering is his song. It is his prayer. He is bringing an offering to God of worship. Not just an offering in an animal, but an offering of his heart, of his prayer, of his song. And once that prayer is offered, David watches. In the morning I prepare a sacrifice for you and watch. That's not God who is watching. God has been listening to his prayer. It's David who prays and then watches. John Calvin calls it like being a sentinel, like one who is on guard, looking out. And in this case, we are watching for God to answer. That's why this is a watchful prayer, a watchful call for God to come in here and help. Which leads to the second stanza, which is about theological remembrance, verses 4 through 6. A theological remembrance. Verse 4 begins with the conjunction for, or because. In the morning I prepare a sacrifice for you and watch, for you are not And then he goes on to describe it. This is an explanation of why he prays and why he watches. This is an explanation of why he can depend on this king to help him because of what God is like. So this is a new stanza, but it is explaining the cause of why we can have such anticipation. Look at verse 4. For you are not a God who delights in wickedness. Evil may not dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all evildoers. You destroy those who speak lies. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. Now this song is not telling God who he is as if he doesn't remember. For you are not a God like this. This is not telling God what he is like as if he doesn't remember any more than the imperatives in the first stanza were commanding God to do something that he otherwise was uninclined to do. So the reminder, the theological reminder, is not for God. It is a way to praise God for what we need to remember. This is who our God is. Our God says that blessing is when your table is full all around you. Like olive plants thy children, compassing thy table round. That's one of the things that God gives as blessing. We're the ones who need to remember that God is like that, and we're the ones who need to remember that God hates evil, that He is King, that He is God, and that He has no sympathy, no pleasure whatsoever in wickedness or evil or boasting or evildoers or lies or bloodthirsty or deceitful men. The song is a reminder for the singers as it praises God. We remember what He is like, what His character and nature is like. He is praised by that, and we are benefited by that. We're encouraged by that. David says, you are not a God who delights in wickedness. God has no affection. There is no want or like that God has for wickedness, for violence, for criminal behavior. In fact, the next phrase, evil may not dwell with you. Dwell is actually an unfortunate translation in the ESV because this particular word for translated dwell is more like visit. Evil doesn't even belong on a short visit with you. You can't even stand to have it in your presence at all for any length of time, however short it is. Usually when we think about dwell, we think about it making it's home there, or we're at home in the place where we dwell. That's absolutely true as well. But in this case, evil can't even be in his presence for a little bit. It doesn't belong. Instead, the boastful shall not stand before your eyes. That fits with how evil doesn't dwell, doesn't belong there. The boastful can't stand before your eyes. You hate all evildoers. And this is where someone says, well, hate is an awfully strong word, and that's what makes it the right word. It is the strength of the word that makes it so applicable. You destroy those who speak lies. Yahweh, or the Lord, abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. He has no delight, verse 4. He hates, verse 5. He abhors, verse 6, sin and sinners. And note that this is not disconnected from the people. We have the phrase, and I think it probably has some to do with one of the verses in Jude, where it says we are trying to rescue the man out of the fire even though his garment has been spotted by sin. And that has come down to us as hate the sin, love the sinner. Perhaps there's some way that we can see how that can apply. Except for when we see how God deals with sin, God does not hate sin in the abstract, because sin is not this thing that just floats around out above our heads. Sin is what comes from people. Sinners, sin. People, persons, sin. God cannot hate sin as this idea and not hate the persons who are committing it. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no redemption, and obviously, He sent His Son to do something about sinners. But when it comes to His nature, that's what makes the sending of His Son to then take on that penalty so significant, because God hates it. He detests it. He abhors those who are wicked. It doesn't belong with Him at all. Though the wicked are generalized in this stanza, verses 4 through 6, I would point out the significance that the prevalent sin here involves the mouth. Note the different sins that are being described here. Yes, wickedness is general, evil is general. But then when he starts getting specific, the boastful, those who speak lies, and the deceitful. If you go down to the fourth stanza, verses 9 and 10, you actually see that the mouth comes back again. There's no truth in their mouth. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Let them fall by their own counsels. What is being stressed in this psalm is not just general evil, but tongue troubles. The words that are being used as an attack on David. Words are their weapons. Those who suppose that ancient people were less sophisticated and that all they knew how to do was grunt at each other underestimate how long words have been vile. How long people have been attacking one another with words, going after each other with lies and slander and deceitful things. Words hurt differently than swords, yes, but sins of speech are just as detestable to God. Remember that next time you watch a presidential news conference. And when you think about what God's response to that is, be encouraged. He hates it. He has no tolerance for the lies and the spin of politicians and other leaders. When you are confronted by a coworker who is slandering you, and you wonder, I wonder how God feels about that. Be encouraged. God hates it. God is the one who is authoring that part of the story. God has something for you to do in it. But He has no appreciation or affection for the actual sin that's coming from that other person. When a family member attacks you for whatever reason it might be, verbally, we can be grateful that blood is not shed immediately in our culture and context. But in some cases, blood eventually does come. The lies that the government tells are actually leading to a lot of blood of babies. I'll come back to that in the fourth stanza. But the lies and the deceit do actually get colored red even in our day. So again, we're not necessarily under threat of being murdered by evil people like they would be maybe in other times or in other parts of the world. But God hates those sins and the sins of the tongue, and we have known and seen and experienced some of those types of things that God hates. The theological remembrance that we sing about is for our hopefulness. This is who our God is. Which leads to fearful worship in the third stanza, verses 7 and 8. Fearful worship. In contrast to the wicked, David describes himself as a worshiper. But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. I will bow down toward your holy temple in the fear of you. Lead me, O Lord, in your righteousness because of my enemies. Make your way straight before me. The opposite of evil to God is holiness. So in God's perspective, the opposite of wickedness is righteousness. Unrighteousness, righteousness, wickedness, holiness. But the opposite for us of evil and wickedness is mercy and grace. Because were it not for grace, we also would be those ones that God detests and hates. We all know what sin is like, and David acknowledges that from the beginning. But I, there is a contrast. He sees that he is not the same as those God hates. But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. David does not lift up his own righteousness and his own innocence. He knows that what distinguishes him is God's grace. Steadfast love is the Hebrew word chesed. And it's way back in the back of your throat. And it can be translated a variety of ways. Steadfast love is a typical way. Grace or mercy or covenantal kindness. All of those do well. Without this covenant-keeping love and mercy, we would all be toast. We could not stand in His presence. We could not be with Him for a moment. But because of His steadfast love, we can worship. We can enter His house. Bow down before your holy temple in the fear of you. So when we see the things that God hates, when even those things that God hates are aimed at us, we're the target, what do? We should remember not only that God hates evil and wickedness, in particular, tongue trouble and tongue sins. We ought to remember that. We also ought to remember how we get to come to God by His mercy, and we ought to sing. We ought to come and worship. He's the one who can do and is doing something about our needs. Too often, I know what it's like, too often, especially in the ones where our physical life is not threatened, where it's somebody who is just talking bad about us somewhere, we want to go to the interwebs and we want to post verses on Facebook or Twitter, or we want to make snarky comments, or we want to get on the phone or text people or go to the coffee shop and have a meeting with a friend with a sympathetic ear. We want to go everywhere else with all of these things that we feel like are unfair, aimed at us wrongly, to express our irritation. But even while we acknowledge that it's painful, that should remind us to fear God who hates it, and it should remind us that we would be like that apart from grace. We would be committing the same sorts of sins apart from His steadfast love. David acknowledges that his opposite is to come and worship in the grace he's received, and he knows that when he worships, that will cause him to go out differently. Lead me, O Yahweh, in your righteousness because of my enemies. Make your way straight before me. In other words, we're depending on his guidance to guard us from unrighteousness, both unrighteousness that could well up in ourselves and the unrighteousness of those who are around us. We need to remember his position toward unrighteousness. He hates it. And we need to remember his power toward his own. He helps us walk right. We worship Him, we acknowledge who He is, and that changes us. We depend on Him for sake of living. Which leads to the fourth stanza and expected judgment, verses 9 and 10. Another four, the conjunction four, another explanation starts this stanza. Lead me, O Lord, in your righteousness, because of my enemies, make your way straight before me, because there is no truth in their mouth. I'm needing your help to walk straight because I'm in the midst of trouble. He's explaining why he is needing the Lord's guidance and help. Look at verse 9. For there is no truth in their mouth. Their inmost self is destruction. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Make them bear their guilt, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Because of the abundance of their transgressions, cast them out. For they have rebelled against you. This is not a pretty picture. There is no truth in their mouths, not even a little. From their heart, from the inside, things are rotten. And it works itself up. Irritable heart syndrome. Just comes out. There's no truths in their mouth. Their inmost self is destruction. Meaning that from the inside they are bent. And they are bent on causing problems and pain in other people. Their throat is an open grave. When they open their mouth, you see decay and the stench of death comes out. One of the Light's old friends named George Zemek, Dr. Zemek, he's got a series on Psalms. I was listening to it this afternoon. He called this ethical halitosis. That when they speak, stench and death come out. That's what it looks like. That's what it smells like. It's rotten. They flatter with their tongue. They make blood somehow seem sweet. They talk in such a way that destruction seems edifying, like calling it women's choice. Speaking in such a way that sounds like good and life when it actually is a cover for blood. We're in major trouble when our country as a whole, I mean, I get not individually along the way, maybe not even the majority of people within, but from the government standpoint, we are a country of liars and covering death and stench and decay and rottenness with nice-sounding platitudes and sound bites. And we wonder why kids grow up that way. Obviously, they come out with Adam's heart. So they already know how to sin. We don't have to teach them how to sin. But it's also true that we like to imitate those that we see. And as parents, we try to provide a better example for our kids to want to grow up and be like. But when our kids see commercials and they listen to presidents and politicians and other people who are all detested by God, they can learn how to do that. They can learn how to spin. They can learn how to try to make what is awful look good. Even when they just punch their sibling and somehow try to explain why that was actually good for their sibling. And they learn how to do it. And it's a significant problem. David sings about their end. These are the kinds of lyrics we don't have in most of our Michael W. Smith songs. Toby Mac is not rapping about this. We have lost our imprecatory edge. David sings about the end they deserve. Make them bear their guilt, O God. Let them fall by their counsels. They set the trap. Let them fall into it. This is not karma. It is the sovereign application of you reap what you sow. God, cause them to reap what they have sown. They might experience the judgment and not even know it. They might think everything is great. They might think that they're actually, through their lies, through their open-graved throat, getting ahead in the world, making a name for themselves. But that could actually be just as much God's punishment on them as His blessing. In fact, if David is getting his way, it would be judgment. Because of the abundance of their transgressions, cast them out, for they have rebelled against you. Which probably means that these enemies, these tongue-talking enemies against David were within his own country, not from some outside foreign land. These were fellow Jews who should have known better. And David calls God to cast them out. We sing about it because we're taking our groaning to God, and we sing about it to remind us of their end so that we don't start going down that path ourselves. For what it's worth, Paul quotes verse 9 in Romans 3, verse 13, in the middle of his long summary of the guilt, no, not one, not even one, after he had shown how everybody is guilty, and then specifically how moral people were guilty, and then even how the Jews were guilty, then he summarizes there from Romans 3, 10 to 18 with a whole catena, a whole list of Old Testament passages. He includes this one about their throat as an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. It is a sign of man's depravity. It is a sign that God hates it and a reason why we need grace. Because otherwise it gets judgment. But for the righteous, it leads to the last positive part of the song. So the fifth and final stanza, verses 11 and 12, joyful singing. The final stanza, joyful singing. Our words ought to have a different ring to them, and there is refuge in our rejoicing. Look at verse 11. But let all who take refuge in you rejoice. Let them ever sing for joy, and spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may exult in you. For you bless the righteous, O Lord. You cover him with favor as with a shield. So there are those who use their tongue as liars, and there are those who use their tongue as singers. Those are really the options. You use your tongue as an instrument of destruction, or you use your tongue as an instrument of praise. You don't go immediately from being one who destroys with your words to being one who brings life with your words without the worship in between, with worshiping God who brings life with His words. Then we start becoming more like Him again. That centerpiece is absolutely crucial, that worshiping, singing peace. Even in the midst of the trouble, we are not left without protection, and our protection is not minimal. We ought to rejoice. We are refugees. When you have a refuge and you run into it, every time kids sing that song, it makes me think of they're running into it and somehow they are saved. But anyway, if you have a refuge, you are a refugee. Refugees who are being protected by God are rejoicers. We're not huddled up in fear. We are singing loud in our enthusiasm to God. We even sing for joy that Yahweh will spread His protection over us, that those who love His name may exult in Him. His name is sweet to us. His name represents His involvement and His win. He provides cover for His people and blessing. You bless the righteous, O Yahweh. You cover him with favor as with a shield. This word for shield is not one of those soldiers' smaller shields that could be held by the arm while fighting. This was one of those full-body shields that provided significant coverage. God covers His people who come to Him as a refuge. He covers them with His favor, with His blessing. And so there is a refuge in rejoicing, because we can only rejoice in God. He is our help. He is our protection. So the end of groaning for those who fear God is rejoicing. The end of our story is song. We acknowledge that God is the author. We know that the story is His from beginning to end and every detail in between. But the end of our story is song. Read Revelation for like actually the end of the story. There's worshiping and singing and rejoicing and exaltation. And in the meantime, we do that as well. Rejoicing is a refuge because the joy of the Lord spills over for us to know and share. Now, when it comes to our groaning, based on the fact that this is a song written by David for the choir master to lead the congregation in, I would encourage you to consider that groaning is intended to be a community project. That groaning is not something that we take care of on our own, personally, privately, without ever dealing with it in public. This is not to say, not trying to say that every little detail has to be shared and given out, just like not every little detail is included in David's song. But the fact that David brings this groaning into the corporate context of worship is a way to show us that groaning is something that we bring to the community of worshipers. We bring our groaning out of isolation. We bring our groaning to God. We bring our groaning in worship to learn how to respond and so that we can remember the Lord's character and His promises. If in our groaning we stay home and watch more reasons on the tube that cause our groaning, the groaning is not going to go away. You can't drown your groaning in movies and football and commercials and cable news. Groaning doesn't get dealt with there. Maybe there are minutes or hours of distraction, but it can't be dealt with. The way to deal with groaning is to bring it to God, and in this case, to do it in the gathered group singing, just like the choir master would be leading the people of Israel. Now, obviously, Jesus Himself is not found in this psalm because He didn't come for a while longer. But Christ is the ultimate fulfillment of every exaltation in this passage. And Christ is also the fulfillment of God's hatred against evil and steadfast love so that any could actually have a relationship with Him. It is on the cross that more judgment was given than all of the years of eternity added up in hell. It was on His own Son that God put our transgressions and iniquities. The cross, the gospel, the good news includes the fact of God's nature that He hates wickedness, that it cannot dwell with Him even for a moment, that it doesn't belong with Him, and that the only ones who can come to Him and find His refuge as a protection are those who come through Christ. And this song prepares the way for that very specific understanding for us. We look back not only at this song, but we look back at Christ and we see God's character both as sovereign. He crushed His Son. We see God as holy. He hates evil. He must punish it. And we see God as gracious, full of steadfast love, providing forgiveness for those who will believe. And all of those things belong with God. And the only way to really hold all of that in tension sometimes is to sing, is to have some sort of art to put that together. Because just stated propositionally, some logic chopper at the end says, well, that doesn't fit. He can't be sovereign and hate evil and be gracious all at the same time. Well, that's why we need a song. And that's why we have the Psalms. And that's why we need to learn them so that we can grow up and understand who our God is and have that encouragement that He provides. Father, thank You for David and for his experience and for his writing. He didn't write this from his imagination, no doubt. He did write it in the midst of one of the many difficult, trying times he faced. And perhaps even at this moment when he was writing, he felt alone and abandoned. And what he needed was to remember who he worshipped and remember the end for those who do worship. To remember that You are God who hates evil and God who provides a cover, a spread, a shield of favor over Your people who come and worship You fearfully, but yet jubilantly, enthusiastically. So help us be those who ever sing for joy, who take refuge in You and rejoice. We ask that You would make us more and more righteous by Your grace, that You would bless us and cover us with Your favor. And we ask this in the name of Your Son. Amen.